Dear Dhamma friends, we have come to the next item of this mindfulness for young adults session. So that is Sutta discussion or Dhamma talk. And basically these days we are discussing Khaggavisana Sutta, which is talking about how one may conduct, how one may behave as a rhinoceros horn. So the rhinoceros horn represents very steady and secluded practice. And this steady secluded practice is one aspect of the spiritual practice which Buddha has mentioned. And this throughout the rhinoceros horn sutta or Khaggavisana sutta, this feature is quite highlighted. So everywhere we can recognize the term, one should live alone like a rhinoceros horn. So this is the repeated theme, repeated sentence that we can recognize throughout the discourse. One should live alone like a rhinoceros horn. But by the way, we don't need to exaggerate it, thinking that this is the only way one can do. There are seclusion while being with others. So different types of seclusion Buddha has mentioned. One aspect is the bodily seclusion, kaya viveka. The other aspect is the freedom from hindrances, citta viveka. And then the freedom of all the defilements. So that is the upadhi viveka. So different levels of viveka, different levels of seclusion, therefore we can recognize. At the beginning as a practitioner, it's always helpful to have some sort of a secluded place if one can have a private place for one's practice. So that actually helps to calm down the mind. But later when mindfulness increases and when the concentration increases, especially say with the walking meditation, then actually you can even practice while at home, while on the way, while at your office. So as your mindfulness and concentration improves, so it will bring wisdom into the picture. So with that, actually, we are constantly on guard with the mind. Constantly, you are observing the mind, how mind behaves, how mind reacts, and what are the different defilements arising in the mind. So likewise, different opportunities arise as you are in different states or as you are in different associations with others. So therefore, it's a kind of a different situation. At the beginning, you need to have some seclusion to develop necessary qualities, like you are in a training camp. But the real war is at the battlefield. So that is where you are going back to the office, you are coming back home, you are dealing with others. And at that time, how mind reacts. So that is also something very interesting and something very challenging that you have to incorporate. Now in this verse, it is fairly talking about the Sotapanna state, stream meaning. And one time there's a king who was ruling the ancient India named Brahmadatta. And he was interested in finding freedom from all the different types of views. And he wanted to maintain his mind free from different views. So he is asking from others, from other ministers, advisors, so what is the way to keep the mind free from various different types of views? So ditti. So ditti is something coming not immediately, but with overthinking, your mind becomes conditioned. Say, for example, you see something. And once you see something, so that image may be recorded in your mind, if you like that image. And later you start to recall that image. So mentally now you are having a sort of a replica of that image. Now you are thinking about that image. So it has become a mental image now. So with this mental image, now again and again you are thinking. Now as you think, so this image becomes something this image become very important, or this image become someone, and you are attributing this image to someone. You saw someone about a year ago. Now this image represents that particular person. So image become that person. So you are attributing this image to someone. And now you are thinking in different ways about starting with this image. Now you are thinking more and more. So as a result of that, your mind become conditioned. Your mind become somewhat inclined towards a particular way of thinking. Now it's very difficult to change. Suppose you saw someone while you are on your way to office, and suppose he appears like a bad person. So you probably might even had an argument or had a kind of a hot discussion. So it has given you some sort of a perception into your mind. And after coming back home, you're thinking about that incident. Now that person is in your mind. You're thinking in many different ways. And ultimately, you decide, okay, he's a bad person. I should never associate. He's something like this. He should be like this. He should have done like this. He will do like this. So likewise, you are adding more and more things to the picture. And ultimately, your mind become conditioned, and now you have many preconceived ideas. And ultimately, your mind is fairly fixed onto that way of thinking. Now, assume that later on, if you see the same person, so immediately that thought pattern comes out and your mind is conditioned to think in that light. So your previous experience has a great influence of how you are thinking now. So likewise, different views are fairly ingrained to our mind, or we can even say engraved to our mind. So it's very difficult to erase now. Like you are engraving something on a stone or maybe on a metal. So it's difficult to erase. Similarly, when you are thinking in wrong way again and again, so ultimately it becomes inculcated in the mind, strongly stored in the mind. And as a result of that, now your mind is fairly conditioned. And this is how mind will operate in the future. According to that pre-stored procedure, we can see, pre-stored way of thinking. Now, this king understood now there's a danger in this sort of a procedure. So how to keep, maintain the mind free from different types of views, especially the personality view, thinking this body belongs to me, thinking this body is I, this body is mine, or different feelings are me, or different feelings are mine. Different types of perceptions are me or mine, or different mental formations. How I am reacting, what are my intentions, what are the qualities, what are my skills. So all those things are representing me or mine, myself. So different thinking patterns represent me, myself. So likewise, so we are attributing a self to different types of experiences, and we believe there is a person. In the body, there is a person. In the perceptions, there is a person. In the feelings, there is a person. In different types of formations, there is a person. So likewise, now we are attributing a person, an individual, a self, onto different experiences. So this is what typically we call as archetype, the personality view. Now, in this verse, so this king recognized, so there's a danger here. There's a preconditioning here. So he couldn't get a satisfactory answer from the others for his question, how to eliminate this view. So what he did was he became a monk. He left the palace. He left the kingdom. And he became a monk. Now he started practicing, and he was able to become a Paccheka Buddha. And now he met so many other Paccheka Buddhas, and there he explained how he was fairly behaving sometime as a stream winner, it seems. I don't know whether Pacheka Buddhahood either happen immediately, like in the Sammasambuddha stage. Say, for example, in the Sammasambuddha, it is not that Sammasambuddha may first become a Sotapanna, and then after some time he become a Sakadagami, after some time he become an Agami, then after some time he become the Arahant Sammasambuddha. But rather it is mentioned in certain books that those stages happen very quickly and he become fully enlightened. But the others, the say for example, Venerable Sariputta, so he became a Sotapanna just after hearing two sentences, so one sentence from Venerable Assaji. Then he became an Arahant after hearing Dhamma discourse from the Buddha. So till that time he was a Sotapanna. So likewise, there are different stages that one may spend till his maturity or understanding grows. Now here, this Pacheka Buddha explains to the others how he spent time alone, practicing alone, because he understood the correct view. Or he understood that his mind is now free from personality view. And now he has to maintain that freedom of mind, that understanding. And he has gained that capacity. Now he has to protect it. So as a result of that, he decided to stay alone. Ditti visukhani upati vatto patto niyamang patiladdha maggu. Uppanna jnanomhi ananyaneyo. Eko chare kagga visana kappu. Ditti visukhani upati vattu. I have transcended the contortions of views. Now different views are there. Mostly the wrong views, michaditti. And now he has transcended them. So basically it represents that he has come to the right view, samaditti. Many different michaditti, wrong views are there. Say there is a person here, or there is a God here controlling everything. Everything belongs to the God. Or there is a soul, self. And sometimes things are happening without a cause. Different types of michaditti. There are 62 types of michaditti explained in the Brahmajala Sutta. And again, Buddha explained 6 types of wrong views, contortions of attributing a self onto one's way of thinking. It is explained in the Sambhasava Sutta. So likewise, so this thinking ultimately lead us to a kind of complexity, complications, fabrications, and ultimately a contortion of views, a thicket of views. So that's a mischaditti, very difficult to get out of it. Now, this Pacheka Buddha mentioned, now at a particular stage, I was able to transcend all these different wrong views and reach the fixed course, obtain the path. Now, that's a very interesting point. Patamo niyamang patiladdha maggu. Patto niyamang patiladdha maggu. Now he has come to the correct path. He recognized the proper niyama. He recognized the proper theory. So what is this proper theory? So those are the things that we can learn from this verse. Patiladdha maggu. Now he has recognized the correct path. So what is this magga? Uppanna jnanomhi ananyaneyo. I have aroused knowledge. I am not to be led by others. Now the wisdom has arisen in me. Now I don't need any advice from others, because I am confirmed about the path. Now I have my own confidence in my own path. So this is a very strong change which happens in one's practice. So since I gained that capacity, eko chare kagga visana kappu, now I live alone like a rhinoceros horn. So till you have confidence in your own practice, so you may go after various teachers. You may read many books thinking that there may be something important, there may be different perspectives. So there may be something missing which I can learn. from this person, from this teacher, from this book, from this sermon. So likewise, so we are not confirmed yet about our own practice. So it is true. So we have to learn from different teachers. We have to read many books. We have to listen to various Dhamma sermons in order to recognize the correct path, definitely. Because we can't expect immediately at the very first instance, we may meet the best teacher, we may meet the best book, we may read the best book, we may encounter the very correct Dhamma. Very difficult to assume like that. We are fortunate, very fortunate if we get that chance, but very unlikely. We might stray in many different ways, when in different paths, and later only we may come to the correct path. And therefore, by the way, we have to again understand, even though we might recognize different teachers, but there are still some common aspects to the Buddha's teaching that many other teachers are also telling. So we may still gain some capacity. We may develop certain skills. So that very development helps us to further assess the teacher, further assess the teaching, what he is teaching. So there may be, certainly sometimes, we come to the understanding, okay, this teacher is a good teacher. He is talking with some understanding, with experiential knowledge, and his teaching go in line with the Buddha's teaching. So this is the path to follow. But on the other hand, with our own understanding, we probably come to the conclusion. So this is not the path. I have to change the teacher. His teaching does not in line with the Buddha's teaching. So I have to shift the teaching, the teacher. So likewise, we may have to sometimes take some radical decisions. So confronting the teacher or meeting the best teacher at the very first instance is a fortune in a way. It has actually happened to Venerable, Kassapa, for example. So Venerable Mahakassapa, so he, before he become the Venerable, so he is Pippali and he renunciated house. And then he approached the Buddha directly. So, and Buddha also understood that this is a very fortunate and very smart, profound person. And he is coming to meet the Buddha. And if anybody meets him, tell that I am the teacher, I am the Buddha. And if this person go on to refuge on him, so the teacher will be in trouble. So to such extent, Venerable Kassapa, Pippali was so fortunate, we can say. He has come to the perfection of the Parami. So therefore, Buddha go in front of him, and he was sitting under a tree, and then Venerable Kassapa approached him. Pippali approached him, and he paid respect. And he immediately mentioned, you are the teacher. You are the Buddha. So please show me the path. So I am going to be a disciple of yours. And he is telling it wholeheartedly. And then Buddha mentioned, if someone not being the Buddha, if he is telling, I am the Buddha, I am the teacher to a person like you, so this teacher will be in big trouble. But I being the Buddha, Samma Sambuddha, I am telling, yes, this is the path. You come and practice the path. So likewise, there are very interesting stories into the Buddha's life, how he, as a Buddha, he shows his real capabilities. And there are some other occasions, he, through his Dhamma, he allowed the person, the listener, the disciple to understand, okay, this is the teacher. This is the real truth. This is the real teaching. So the Buddha doesn't sort of explain himself as the teacher or explain himself that I am the Buddha. Rather, he simply preaches the Dhamma. So the listener now, through understanding and practicing the Dhamma, he realized, so this person can't be a normal teacher. This is the Samma Sambuddha. So likewise, there are many different approaches we can see. Anyway, so in this verse, this particular Paccheka Buddha highlights that once he become a stream winner, Sotapanna, now he is confident. It is not necessary to have someone else's instructions because now he is confident and he knows the path and he knows the theory. And I found a very interesting sutta that goes in line with this verse, which is comes in the Samyukta Nikaya Nidana Samyukta, which is called Panchavera Bhaya Sutta. There Buddha mentioned what are the certain qualities and certain, say, skills a Sotapanna is having, stream winner is having. And there he mentioned, so a Sotapanna, stream winner, is free from five types of animosities. Free from five types of animosities. Actually, these five animosities are nothing but the five precepts. So Buddha mentioned, one who destroys life, that means Panatipata, one who destroys life engenders, on account of such behavior, fearful animosity pertaining to the present life and fearful animosity pertaining to the future life. And he experiences mental pain and displeasure in this life. Suppose someone is killing animals, and as a result of that, while killing, he is burning himself. He may be angry, he may be neglectful, he is ignorant, he doesn't know the repercussions. So he is killing. While killing, he is putting himself in danger. And again, later when he thinks about it, if it comes to his mind, so those memories also start to burn him. And on the other hand, in the future, because of this wrongdoing, so he may have repercussions. He may have bad vipaka, karma vipaka. And as a result of that, he probably have to go to hell realms. Or even if he get the human birth, he may die early. Or he may get a lot of sickness. So likewise, many bad vipaka consequences are there. So these are the dangers with respect to killing animals. Now, when Sotapanna, when he has become Sotapanna, so these dangers are no more to him. So similarly, Buddha mentioned, when someone is taking what is not given, he's stealing. So as a result of stealing, there are dangers, there are animosities, there are bad results. Someone is blaming, you may get caught to the police, or you get in imprisonment. Or in the future births, you will be in trouble, go to hell realm. Or when you are thinking about what you did, you start to regret, you start to burn yourself. So likewise, so the stealing also has such kind of consequences. Similarly, sexual misconduct. So there are also various types of consequences are there. And when you are lying, that also has similar consequences. And the fifth, when one indulges in liquor, wine, intoxicants, and that you become negligent because of that. So basically you are losing complete control and you become completely unmindful. So as a result of that, you become really vulnerable to the dangers. And in the future life also, you become mad, foolish, and you are maybe even at a later stage of your life, you may be regretting how you have behaved. So likewise, these dangers are there. So with respect to these five precepts, there are many dangers. So if you are not protecting them, but stream winner, so he is free from these dangers. So that is the first aspect. Buddha mentioned that one is enjoying when he become a stream winner. So he may not intentionally kill an animal, which is a gross impact or gross offense, which may take him to the hell realm. There may be mistakenly he may kill animals, but purposely planned intentional killing may not happen. Similarly, planned intentional stealing may not happen. Planned intentional sexual misconduct may not happen. An intentional lying may not happen. And intentionally taking intoxicants may not happen. So he's free from these dangers. So that is one aspect of the Sotapanna Buddha mentioned. And then there are four factors, one can say certain good qualities a stream winner has, he possesses. Four factors of stream entry that he possesses. The noble disciple possesses confirmed confidence in the Buddha. So he know, okay, this is the teacher. Buddha is the teacher. So he has proclaimed Dhamma. And there are a group of people who are following it sincerely. Because he himself is following it. He himself is an example. He himself he is in the same group of the Sangha. And he know who else are also trying to go in the same line. Because he feel in the sense, he understand, okay, this person is also talking the same line. He's also trying to further correct himself. And he is revealing his mistakes. And he's further trying to enhance his mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. So likewise, he easily can compare himself with others because he too in the same category. And he is confident of his sila. That is the fourth aspect. He possesses the virtues dear to the noble ones. And that virtues, that sila, unbroken, untorn, unblemished, unmottled, freeing, praised by the wise, ungrasped, lead into concentration. Now, typically, sometimes we observe precepts, sila, to show off, to show that I am also a good person, I am also protecting sila. But here, such kind of personality view is not coming to the effect because he is a Sotapanna. So he is honestly practicing sila, observe precepts and maintaining virtues because he understood the advantage. He understood if he is not protecting sila, what are the dangers. Now he is practicing sila wisely, not just believing, but rather with comprehension, with the kind of conviction. Now, so his sila is unbroken. There are maybe, according again, in the Ratana Sutta, Buddha mentioned, if a noble person made a mistake, he doesn't hide it. He immediately go to a companion, he immediately go to a fellow monk, and he confessed, by mistake due to some sort of unmindfulness, I made this mistake. Please accept my fault. So likewise, he confessed rather than hiding it. So likewise, his sila is more pure. And so that is another aspect Buddha mentioned, that these are the four aspects Buddha mentioned that a Sotapanna is having. And what most importantly, what is the theory that he knows? What is the most profound teaching that he has understood? Noble method, but he has understood. So that is nothing but the Paticchasamuppada. Theory of Paticchasamuppada, Idappacheta. So he has understood when this exists, that also exists. When the arising of this, that also arises. And when this does not exist, that also does not exist. And with the passing away of this, that also passes away. For example, with the existence of ignorance, the formations will exist. With the arising of ignorance, the formation, sanskara, also will be arising. If there are no ignorance, there is no possibility of formations to arise. And with the cessation of ignorance, the formations also going to cease. If we apply the same principle to something somewhere else, say you are applying it to Vedana Paccaya Tanha. So when feelings are there, the craving also can arise, can exist. With the arising of feeling, the craving can arise. Craving may arise. But if there are no such feelings, then can't be any craving. And with the cessation of feeling, the craving also ceases. So likewise, this principle. So this principle is what you call as noble principle. Or Ariyo Nyayo. Ariya Nyaya. Noble principle. Ariyo Nyayo Panyaya Sudhitto Hoti. That is how Buddha explained. So the Sotapanna has penetrated this noble principle through his wisdom. So this is the third aspect that Buddha mentioned in this Pancha Vera Bhaya Sutta, five fearful animosities. So in this particular sutta available in the Samyutta Nikaya, so these are the three main aspects. He is free from fearful animosities. He is equipped with these four types of qualities. And again, he has penetrated the noble principle, Ariya Nyaya, noble principle, that is the Dappacheta Parisamuppada. So these are very interesting points that actually we can come through from this verse coming in the Kaggavisana Sutta. So with that, I like to conclude today's Dhamma sermon. Now I like to go for the next item, that is the question and answer session.
I'm sorry, Bhante. Currently there are four questions. Question number one is a general question. Dear Bhante, will meditation help to improve memory capacity? That's the end of the question.
Sorry, can you repeat that, Chatur?
Will meditation help to improve memory capacity?
Yeah. Of course. I can simply tell yes and go to the next question.
Okay. Question number two.
I can actually give a little explanation, by the way. It asked any explanation or...
No, that's all it says.
Yeah, fine. So actually, I found a very interesting explanation given by Venerable Bhikkhu Analayo. So in his book, Satipatthana, The Direct Path, so there he very nicely explained how it happens. Now, how memory works. So that is very interesting. Now, we think that memory will happen or increase when we are repeatedly again and again murmuring the same thing again and again, put it to the mind. So that is also one way of doing it. But on the other hand, how memory increase depends on the how we are storing the data and how we are retrieving the data. So these are the two stages. Suppose you want to memorize something. So during the memorization process, you have to have a very calm, clear mind. And on the other hand, at a later time, when you want to retrieve that information, at that time also, you need to have a very calm, clear mind. So this is how mindfulness practice is helping to develop memory. What happens is, now suppose you are not mindful. So your mind is always scattered, going here and there. And assume that you want to memorize something. So you are reading a book and you are trying to memorize it. So there are many distractions. Again and again, your mind distracts. Again, you are trying to memorize. Again and again, your mind distracts. Now it is very much like you are trying to store something on the hard disk. But again and again, you get the disturbance. Maybe power cuts or maybe due to certain disturbances. Somehow this writing part doesn't happen properly. But on the other hand, assume that you are mindful. So your mind stays in the present moment. Well established in mindfulness. And now less distractions. You are quite steady. And mind also calm. So it is not agitated. and it doesn't have any distractions. Assume on such circumstances, if you are trying to store something, you are trying to memorize something, then it is happening very smoothly because your mind is well concentrated onto the content, and you are looking at the content and you are trying to memorize it, and very smoothly it will store in the mind. So this is the storing process. Later, suppose you may want to retrieve it after, say, a couple of months. Assume that you are constantly developing mindfulness and you are maintaining that skill, and you are now with less distractions and mind is calm and trying to stay in the present moment. And after a couple of months, now you want to retrieve that information. Remember that information. So during that retrieval process also, your mind is calm. And you are not with agitated mind. And your mind is free from the past, whatever the unmindful distractions. And again, you are not ruminating about the future, but your mind is in a calm, quiet situation. Now you want to retrieve it. It is said that is also possible, because this retrieving time also mind is in a very conducive stage. And there are some scientific evidences also, which Venerable Bhikkhu Analeo mentioned. I can't remember that part. So these are the stages that we need to understand. So during the storing process, we are mindful. And during the retrieval process also, we are maintaining mindfulness. As a result of that, our memory capacity will be improved, and as well as it will be very successful. Yeah.
Can I ask a question about that, Bhante? So probably me, with memory, like after doing mindfulness for a long time, I find that I'm actually very forgetful. Just to give an example, like this became a real problem.
So I have to agree with you, with myself. So I am also now a little forgetful. So actually, I forgot to mention that also. Actually, when I want to answer the question, so first of all, I have to tell the positive side. But now I like to add the negative part as well. So like Chatu highlighted. So actually, when we are specially practicing Vipassana, not merely mindfulness. So there are, now you are getting more understanding not only mindfulness, now in the concentration and wisdom is developing. And suppose if you consider your mind, are we storing only the necessary, valuable, beneficial things, or are we keeping many, many unnecessary, invaluable, unbeneficial things? Now, typically, suppose you are going to some sort of an association with the person. Now, he may, while during this association, there may be many incidents happening. And there may be very good positive incidents. But typically, when something wrong happens, we immediately keep it in our mind. And we may try to get revenge. And we are keeping that as a sort of a bad remark about that person. So likewise, our memory also sometimes not happening in a beneficial manner. So it always remembers what he did wrong. Suppose you are living with the person for 10, 15 years. He has helped you many years, many occasions. But the very moment he could have done something wrong, so you give prominence to that and you start to memorize that, remember that, and again and again you are trying to get the revenge because of that. So likewise, our mind actually operates in a very, you know, kind of a cruel manner. So we are memorizing all those bad things. And suppose you are watching a movie. So what are you going to memorize? Are you only memorizing the very interesting and say very beneficial parts? Or are you storing most cruel and say most defiled moments shown in the film? So most defiled, really dirty parts are the ones actually being stored in our mind. So this is how the typical mind works. So our defilements are being aggravated, and those defiled moments are being specially stored in the mind. So that is how even the childhood memories, childhood abusing and all those things, still remember even when you become an adult. So likewise, our memory actually sometimes not even beneficial to us, even it can be harmful to us. But with the practice of vipassana, so we come to a stage that mind doesn't want to grasp anything. So it starts to understand the repercussions or the consequences of grasping, and he understood, or the mind understood, the impermanent nature of things, and again the suffering, and again non-self nature. As a result of that, now mind starts the opposite process. Now rather than grasping, it starts to let go of things. Now even though you see things, your mind is not interested of purposely, intentionally looking at it and grasping it. Even though you hear things, mind is not interested of purposely looking at it and grasping things. So likewise, all these sensory information, mind is not that interested of. Rather, mind like to stay quiet, secluded, mind its own business. So this is a stage that mind reaches. So at this stage, there is a big advantage, as well as there's a small disadvantage also. Disadvantage is that there may be certain necessary information which may have to keep in our mind. So mind may even let it go that. But the advantage is you are not being stressed. You are not grasping. And you are not ruminating. You are not proliferating. And your mind is very cool, calm, quiet. So these advantages as well. To come to that stage, you probably experience some sort of forgetfulness. So that probably may reduce once you come to a kind of a balance in your practice. But still, I feel that, I mean, there is a significant part the mind is not interested of keeping, memorizing. Would you like to agree, Chatu?
Yes, definitely. Question number 2 of 8. This is mindful sitting. Dear Venerable Sir, my sitting practice has been mindful on the breath, and over a time period, thanks to your guidance, I could find a path where the breath settles and transforms to a spacious awareness. This spacious awareness is very relaxing and calm most of the time. I can observe sounds at a distance, awareness of the body, thoughts coming and going after 30 to 40 minutes, some body pains arising. It is possible that the breath also arises in this space and fades away to the space if I don't give any value to them. During some sessions, these objects which come and go become very prominent, and as Venerable Sir guided, I started focusing on the elemental characteristics. I can keep focusing on the elemental characteristics, such as smoothness and hardness of the posture, sensations, hot and cold nature, movements, etc. Even with the thoughts, it seems possible not to involve with the content of the thoughts, but look at them arising and fading away, focusing on the movement. I don't know if this movement is associated with the air element, and even if the elements can be connected with the thoughts, but I feel like that. The very subtle movement I observe in the body sensations, pain and thoughts appear the same. I don't know if I'm going too much with the element observations and mixing it up with the technique of observing thoughts. seeking Venerable's advice with metta? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, I think no need to, I mean, there may be, of course, relationship between the elements and the thoughts. So sometimes it is mentioned, the opposite is also there. The chitta garupa, where because of the mind, there are certain parts of elements going to arise. So there may be other side also available because of the bodily conditions, there are thoughts arising. So there may be such relationships. But what we are mostly paying attention is how thoughts are arising. How in the sense, not really the relationship between the thought and the elements, rather how a thought arising and how we may even give some, say, food to it as a result of that, how it is growing. And how it can become kind of a more obsessive thought, obsessive thinking. And on the other hand, when a thought arising, if we simply recognize it, if we are mindful about it and not promoting it, not strengthening it, how it is started to fade away. Now it becomes weaker. And without long time, it starts to fade away. Now, if you are able to recognize this process, and you may stop feeding them. As a result of that, all these thoughts quickly start to disappear and you may experience heavy calmness and kind of a cool, calm experience, and your mind is free from any thought. So therefore, such mind is something that we can cultivate. So it is not simply you are enjoying some sort of a concentration, samadhi, rather you wisely understood how mind operates. As a result of that, you understood they are quite impermanent. You were the one feeding them and you now stop feeding them. And they simply therefore started to cease. And now you come to a kind of a resting period, kind of a calmness and freedom from any thinking. And at that time, if you are not grasping any feeling or element, or if you are not grasping any other thing, then you reach the emptiness. So that is important. So therefore, try to align your practice according to that.
Question number 3 of 8, mindful sitting. Dear Bhante, many times Bhante highlights that during the practice, if we come across something extremely desirable or something undesirable, such as pain, observe it as not me, not mine, and not my soul, as a third party view. It is possible to logically understand this anatta view, but I am struggling to practically do this. When we come across such an experience, let's say during sitting practice, do we verbalize this understanding so the mind deviates to this view that this is me, not mine, not my soul? Or without any words, should I endure the feeling and try to step out of that experience, noting the attachment with the view of me and mine? I am trying to do this during sitting, which is calm, tranquil, and a simple environment. I doubt during day-to-day experience that this will be more difficult due to chaotic situation of the mind. Even for the simplest situation, using one simple object, appreciate Panthe's explanation with metta. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, so it is true. I mean, at the beginning, actually, we may do it mechanically. So as you mentioned, say you are sort of reminding the mind. So at the moment, at that moment, you actually not really experiencing the non-self, but the mind is trying to grasp, but you are reminding, okay, it is not self, it is not yours. So it is like warning the mind. But there may be instances with your practice, you are really experiencing it. You really understand they are behaving according to their own agenda, and they don't listen to your say command, and they are depending on certain different other causes and conditions. So you at that time understand the real non-self nature. But as you said, at this level, you are very much like reminding yourself, warning yourself not to grasp. So both are needed, both are necessary.
Question number 4 of 8. This is mindful walking. Dear Bhante, I would like to ask about how to manage the situation when the mind drifts away when I'm walking. For example, the sensations on the sole of the foot. Even with a lot of effort and after many attempts, I could not be aware of the exact moment the mind drifts away or the way my mind drifts to something else. I only get to know that I'm with thoughts or listening to something after it happens, sometimes within seconds or maybe after several minutes. I don't know how to catch or to get to know this drifting away, how this drifting away process works. Is this something I should work on to improve? The technique I use to bring the mind back is to check that if I am aware of the sensations of the sole of the foot. If I do it with a lot of vigilance and effort, I observe the mind snaps back immediately and stays with the walking process. If I do it gently, I observe the mind comes back as drifting, slowly comes back and settles, synchronizing with the walking process. With these observations, I can say that I can be aware of how the mind returns back after distraction, but not yet how it triggers to deviate. Lots of merits for your guidance and insights, Bhante. That's the end of the question.
Yeah. General advice is we should not push the mind back to the object. Rather, we better allow it to smoothly come back. So it is true that you are recognizing mind has distracted. At the very moment, the mindfulness regained. So you are smoothly putting it back to the necessary object. Because, you know, the mindfulness, it is not necessary to be in the same object. So you can be with different objects. At the same time, can maintain the unbroken mindfulness. Object doesn't matter much. But in the practice, it is not merely the mindfulness, but also we are trying to improve concentration. So we are selecting some sort of a phenomena which is happening at the same place, like breath. And we are trying to be mindful about that. So as a result of that, so not only mindfulness, the concentration also builds up. So that is where we need to again and again come to the breath. So the mindfulness improves as a result. And again, the concentration also improves. So if you are aware, if the mind has distracted, so don't worry about it. Don't blame yourself. Rather smoothly bring it back. Yeah.
Question number 5 of 8. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, multitasking is very popular among people and most people do their work using this method. Can you please explain how this will affect the human mind or brain? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually, I like to show a little video then about that. Actually, someone else has had that question and I was able to gather some information about it. And there are recent findings available that it shows scientifically that it is harmful. So it is not really useful, rather it is harmful. So let me see. So multitasking. So there are, actually it is mentioned.
Turns out that.
So let me share this little video so that it speaks very clearly. How multitasking could be harmful to us rather than really useful or beneficial.
Turns out that multitasking is a myth. We think that we're doing a whole bunch of things at once. But we're not actually, because the brain doesn't work that way. And a number of studies now have shown, from Earl Miller's lab at MIT and others, that what we're really doing is we're paying attention to one thing for a little bit of time, and then another, and then another, and then we come back around to the first. And all of these are separate projects that are occurring in separate parts of the brain. They require a separate start time, separate monitoring process. And you end up fractionating your attention into little bits and pieces, not really engaging fully in any one thing. All that switching across tasks comes with a neurobiological cost. It depletes resources. So after an hour or two of attempting to multitask, if we find that we're tired and we can't focus, it's because those very neurochemicals we needed to focus are now gone. There are some jobs that require not multitasking, because we know it doesn't exist, but this kind of rapid switching.
Traffic controller, simultaneous translator at the UN, journalists, monitoring all these different things at once. And we can take a tip from the air traffic controllers who, as part of their duty cycle, are required after every hour and a half or 2 hours of work, it's mandated that they take a 15 to 30 minute break. And that means an unplugged, disconnected break where they go for a walk or they listen to music, they exercise, something to restore all of the burned up neurochemicals. You might ask, during this period of our evolution when there's all this information, is the brain adapting and changing? And yes, it is. The brain adapts and changes all the time. Evolution is happening all the time. Unfortunately, it's rather sluggish. We talk about it in terms of evolutionary lag. And generally speaking, it takes about 20,000 years for the brain to catch up with the way the environment is and in terms of how it's encoded in the genome. So 20,000 years from now, our brains may have evolved to deal with it. In the meantime, we have to employ strategies, just a little bit more self-discipline than we currently use, to filter out unwanted or unnecessary input. I'm not talking about never letting something frivolous or fun in, but I'm talking about adopting a kind of a habit of allowing yourself to focus on one thing at a time for at least a few hours a day.
So I think that video has given you the answer.
I agree, Bhante.
I
saw something similar to that at work. They're doing sort of like a mindfulness thing there, and it was a similar result. Basically, what they said was, if you're checking emails, it takes about 90 seconds for you to come back to what you were doing. So you actually waste time constantly checking emails. It's not efficient. It doesn't. And basically the same message, that multitasking is not real. Anyway, question number 6 of 8, general question. Dear Bhante, I would like to share an experience that I recently had and get your opinion on it. Before going to sleep one day, I thought about what are some things that I have to do the next day, like expectations, and I couldn't find a single thing. So I tried to think about lockdown ending and going back to work, living normally without masks maybe, and be able to go anywhere I wanted. I realized they are not in my expectation list. Then I thought about my family, children going to school and their future, uni and me as a retiree, etc. I still couldn't find a thing to look forward to the next day. Then I turned to the practice. I thought about maybe furthering my practice, going to Nisarnamania, becoming a monk, etc. But no, nothing. I could not find a single thing in my head that I was looking forward to. I was sad, happy, confused, and all at the same time. Then I realized that through the practice, would definitely not find anything to look forward to, as you do without expectations. So what is this state, Bhante? Is it a fluke in my mind, or is it the practice telling me something? Much merits for your advice as always. Everyone, Sarnite. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, I think we don't need to encourage it, that kind of expectations too much, because these expectations does not really bring us to the kind of success. So rather, doing our daily practice is the key. So there may be very high goals, high objectives, but that makes ourselves sometimes burdened, because we are keeping a very huge goal in ourselves and reminding that still I am not there, still I am not there, still I couldn't achieve it. So that actually makes ourselves somewhat frustrated. Rather, you are happy with the ongoing process. It is not that you are neglectful about your practice. You do the daily practice. Assume that in the morning you practice some time, and again, whenever you have time, sometimes you are doing some walking meditation, maybe at home you may be practicing in the evening, at night you are practicing. So likewise, you are maximally say, maximally using the time to spending your time on the practice. So that indicates that you are not neglectful. So if you are doing like that, no need to think too much about the future, say, expectations, because the practice may happen smoothly and bring you there. Like you are growing a tree. So during the, I mean, assume that you are planting a tree, a little plant, and you are watering it and you are manuring it. And slowly it may start to grow. So it's your duty to look after it and to put some fertilizer and put some water if it is necessary. And if there are any insects and all the disturbances, threats that you have to avoid. So likewise, you are looking after the plant. So daily, very slowly, it is growing. And ultimately, it becomes a huge tree. Same thing applies to the mind. Same thing applies to our own practice. So it's a matter of looking after our mind, looking after our practice, and doing the daily practice. That's it. And then it is becoming not a burden to yourself. So you don't consider this as a kind of a burden that I have to do this. Still, I haven't come to this. I haven't reached this stage, this goal, something like that. You don't need to think.
Bhante, I wasn't keeping track of time. We've gone over and I've got another four questions. What do we want to do?
Yeah, we'll put a few more, say 3:15 Sri Lanka time. That means another, say, 13 minutes.
All right. We'll go through it quickly. Question 7 of 10, general question. Dear Bhante, thank you for the excellent explanation of the qualities of Sotapanna during the Dhamma sermon today. It is very clear that I'm nowhere near the state considering the fears in my mind. I'm trying to protect the five precepts, but I'm afraid of the consequences and repercussions. I thought this Baya Ledger is something fundamental and precious I have. Based on the Dhamma sermon, it also proves that I'm not a Sotapanna, no problem. Is my understanding correct? Thank you, Bhante, for your service. With metta, that's the end of the question.
No, I think Baya Ledger is a different aspect. So that what you call as Hiri Ottappa, is having a different perspective where you are afraid of doing something wrong. You are ashamed of doing something wrong. So that is a necessary quality. So here, Bhaya does not indicate that. So suppose, I mean, you are getting kind of an internal, yearning to do something wrong. But at that time, there is sort of a Bhaya, fear, coming and telling you, okay, this is not suitable and there are certain repercussions available. So that Baya Ledger, that Hiri Ottappa is a positive quality you need to cultivate, you need to have. So no harm in having it. And Buddha mentioned when you are developing mindfulness and clear comprehension, that becomes the base for the development of the Baya and Ledger. So the Hiri Ottappa. So therefore, you don't need to worry about that, such kind of a moral fear and moral dread. So that is a positive quality. We need to cultivate it. But here, what is highlighted is that the more kind of a gross kind of, wrong deeds, you are purposely killing animals, intentionally doing stealing, sexual misconduct, intentionally lying, taking intoxicants. So intentionally, you are doing it. So that has kind of a grave impact. So as a result of that, all the consequences are available. For in the sutta, what is highlighted is when Sotapanna is concerned, so he is not intentionally doing such gross kind of wrong activities. But even to him, there may be unintentional wrongdoings might happen. So he doesn't hide them. He simply reveals them and confess them and try to correct himself. So that is highlighted in the, in the Ratana Sutta. Yeah.
Question number 8 of 10. This is a general question. Dear Venerable Bhante, I have observed that a lot of times repetitive past thoughts encourages the development of self-view. Is this observation merely enough? greatly appreciated and much merits with metta. That's the end of the question.
What you are telling is very true. So, I mean, these past thoughts related to the past confirms a person. At the same time, not only that, there may be other things as well. Say, maybe regarding the future. Say, you want to become someone. You want to have a praise, or you are planning for a success. So, if you are doing that, attributing a self, so then again you are making a self. So therefore, I mean, we have to take this very carefully. So does it mean that we should avoid success? So does it mean that we should never plan? So it is not. Basically what it says is, so we have to try hard, we have to do our best, but at the same time not to highlight ourselves, not to show off ourselves, not to sort of expecting a lot of self-gain or self-admiration. Rather, we are doing the duty for the sake of doing it, and that is the good thing, the correct thing to do. That's it. So if we are doing like that, then even if things go wrong, so there may not be much impact, because you know you did something correct, or you tried your best, but things didn't materialize, didn't happen properly. So you lost. That's it. But on the other hand, if you have a lot of personal gain and such kind of things are in mind, then if something go wrong, then you suffer a lot. So likewise, when we are thinking about the future also, the eye-making can happen, mind-making can happen. Even with the present experience, eye-making, mind-making can happen. So therefore, as you said, not the past is one attribute. When we think that something I did, as a result of that, also eye-making, mind-making can happen. Very good question, by the way. Yes, interesting.
Question number 9 of 10. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, can you please explain Idam Pachatta as you mentioned in today's session, please? With metta, that's the end of the question.
Yeah, Idam Pachatta. So that is the theory of Paticchasamuppada. So let me share it. Where is that? So Idam Pachatta is the principle actually. So Idam Pachatta principle is what we call as Ariyo Nyaya. Ariyo Nyaya, Panyaya Suditto Hoti Suppati Viddo. So likewise, it is mentioned Idam Pachatta. So where is that? So this is the point. Hope you can see the screen, Chatu.
Yeah, we can see.
Yeah. When this exists, that comes to be. When the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. So this is the principle that we are highlighting. So it has an interrelationship. In the sense that there is something conditions another thing. Something conditions another thing. So because of this, that comes to be. When this arises, that also arising. And when this does not exist, that doesn't come to be. And with the cessation of this, that also ceases. Say, for example, now if you consider pastapachya vedana, because of contact, the vedana feeling arise. So if there is no contact, then the feeling cannot arise. Simple as that. So with the arising of contact, the feeling arises, and if the contact ceases, that arisen feeling also start to cease. So likewise, this principle is applicable to the any sort of that what you call kind of a duet, that relationship, either avijja paccha sankhara. So you can apply this principle. Say sankhara paccha vijnanam, so you can apply this principle. Vijnana paccha namarupam, you can apply this principle. So actually the principle is the most important thing. Thus, this theory is the most important thing. This principle is the important thing. So that avijñāpaccaya saṅkhārā, saṅkhārapaccaya viññānaṁ, viññānapaccaya nāmarūpaṁ. So those are actually the examples which satisfy this theory. Yeah.
Question number, this is the last one, 10. It's a continuation from the first question about memory. Regarding the memory question, the forgetful instance, is it because some of the things you do not pay much attention to are unnecessary things? Examples, gossip about people or news you don't remember. You don't remember them anymore because you do not give much value to them with your practice. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, there is a, there is one aspect. So you find out those are not necessary and those are useless. It's an unnecessary burden to the mind. And on the other hand, more and more, you like to keep your mind open. You like to keep your mind spacious because you understand keeping too many things in the mind is a burden. So it's like very much like you had a kind of a heavy stone on your head. So you understood it's really heavy. It's very tiresome to keep all these things in the mind. So let me keep this on the ground. So now your head is feeling lighter. So likewise, if we are constantly thinking of something and always ruminating on something, and many mental images are always occupied the mind, so it is not an easy state to handle. So you become very confused and the mind is very complicated and always thinking is going on, rumination going on, your inner chatter is going on. Very difficult, actually. Actually, the practice, vipassana practice specially help us to find out a kind of a gap between thoughts, and that gap slowly enhance, prolong, and ultimately you find a kind of a, cessation of thoughts. There are no thoughts at all. So kind of inner silence is there. So it is not necessary to go to the very deep vipassana, but even say you are doing Sakman Bhavana, walking meditation. There are also, so there may be occasions that you are experiencing this kind of a very calm state of mind. So the walking happens, you are quite mindful about it, but no thoughts available in the mind. So likewise, this state is for further growing as you come to the vipassana stage. So at that time, you start to appreciate this spaciousness of the mind, non-grasping state of the mind. So it is so cool, so calm, quiet, spacious, and your mind is very clear. So that kind of positive aspects are there. So even though the mind is empty, so it's a very rich emptiness. So therefore, your mind may get inclined towards that emptiness. So therefore, you are not inclined towards keeping things too much in the mind. So that is also another attribute may be contributing towards not keeping too many things in the mind and therefore forgetting unnecessary things and keeping a mind very lighter. So probably you can maintain a diary.
It's fun. That ends the questions today.
And nowadays, many instruments are there. Actually, I am using Google Calendar, and I have a diary also.
It's funny you mentioned that, Panthe, because I do exactly the same. I use notes on my phone. I have a calendar, and I have notes at work. Otherwise, I just can't remember.
So this is why nowadays people are, inventing all these devices so that we can keep our mind very cool and empty.
Probably.
Yeah. Yes.
That ends the questions, and we've gone over time, so I'll wrap this up very quickly. I'd really like to thank Panthe for going over time and helping answer all these questions out, and also like to pass on our merits and dedications. And also to the people seen and unseen working behind the scenes and participating. And lastly, to the participants, because without you, there would be no program. So with that, I'd like to end. Theravan Sarnai.
Yes, Theravan Sarnai. Sukhi Hotu.